Blog Talk Radio.
Of who that exactly was. I think it was either Brendan the Tabulations.
Yes.
Or Ruby and the Romance. Oh, it was Brendan the Tabulations, mm-hmm. The Touch of You. Thank you. I was really sweating there for a minute. How you
I
doing this evening, darling?
I'm good.
Oh, okay. Well, I want to say good evening to everybody and welcome to this segment of Delicious Talk Radio, bringing sexy back. And I'm your host, Gail Delicious Johnson, here with my guest co-host, Terry Brown. Thank you. I'm sorry. You know, on our shows are for mature listening audiences only, and we discuss sex and other social topics here. Topics we don't discuss are religion and politics. We also have the most fascinating guests on in our studios. And if you're listening to this show and you're not age appropriate, we will not be responsible for our guests or any conversations that may influence you. And hope everybody's enjoying this evening in the warmth of their home. It was kind of some nasty weather here today, but you know, any day is a good day when you wake up on this side of the dirt, so I'm not even going to complain. Okay, I'm going to bring on my two co-hosts that are here. That's Jadino and Terry. How you guys doing this evening?
Oh, I'm outstanding.
Okay, you guys ready for this special guest that we have?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm going to let everybody in the listening audience know a little bit about our guest before I bring her on. She's a noted nonfiction author, Donna Thompson. She's a seasoned true crime writer, guides the readers as they have a peek into the erratic career of well-known adult film star Timothy J. Boham, who used the stage name of Marcus Allen, a striking young man as he seeks to scale the ladder of success in the fascinating field of modeling. Well recognized in her field, Ms. Thomas has a journalist doctoral degree and writes extensively on true crimes and pop culture. She has interviewed dozens of high-profile criminals, including Ted Bundy, Richard Ramirez, Charles Manson, John Gotti, Henry Hill, Scott Peterson, and many others. She regularly appears on radio and television as an expert commentator on true crime. Intended for mature audience, that's the title of the book, exposes little-known facts about the adult porn film industry and introduces the likes of the iconic pornographic Chi-Chi LaRue and big-time porn star Janae Jameson. The twists and turns Boham had to navigate to deal with his own deep-seated wrath leave him in less than a stellar circumstances. He has a growing family to support and was faced with difficult decisions. This is a story of small-town values, evil versus good, relationships, dynamics, the sometimes dark, seedy underbelly of the adult film world. Ms. Thomas spent countless hours with the subject, Tim Bowman, to determine the true facts that lies behind Bowman's, his thirst and hunger as the ill-fated quest for fame and altercation explodes into chaos, love, loss, and murder. Wow. I am really anxious to speak with Donna about this book because I read the book and it's a very, the book is really something. It reminds me a little bit of a book that I wrote. I mean, I didn't write it. A book I read a few years ago, John Holmes. He was another porn star who died from AIDS, but he was involved in the Wonderland murders and different things like that. And the title of that book was A Life Measured in Inches. And two ladies who lived in separate cities collaborated and wrote that book. And that was really fascinating because they didn't really know each other, but they came together somehow on the Internet and they put that book together. And that was another good read that I had read. As far as books that are autobiographies or books that have the truth in them, you know, books that are not nonfiction stories, I'll put it like that. But without further ado, we're going to bring on Donna Thompson and get this show on the road. Good evening, Donna. How are you?
I'm great, and thank you so much, Gail, for having me. I appreciate it.
I am just so fascinated to have you on the show as well because I have questions that, you know, I would like to know. But first, give us a little bit of background, how you became to be a true crime writer.
Well, I have always was interested in the law and have a law degree, did some law, but really, really hated it, you know, because there's a lot of dishonesty in it on both sides, whether you're in the prosecution side of things or the defense, and that part of it I just really didn't care for, but started to really get into, you know, the criminal mind, because that was my foray into it, and just found it just so fascinating, the deviant side of them and the way they think and what makes them tick, and that's just, it just was a natural progression, and when I'm following these true crime cases and writing about them, it really helps because I understand the court and the legal system when they're all in court. You know, they end up there. That's usually the outcome with many of these cases, so I understand all the proceedings, and it helped. One kind of goes to the other, and it's just a fascinating thing to me to deal with them. I mean, it's just like a mental game of chess a lot of times when you sit down with some of these people. And it's just, you got to be on your toes when you're dealing with them. And it's just very, very fascinating to me.
Okay. So when you did your first crime interview, what was going on in your mind when you're sitting next to this person who maybe, because I understand you interviewed Ted Bundy who murdered quite a few young ladies.
Wow.
And, you know, what was going on in your mind while you're sitting there interviewing them?
Well, you know, let me tell you something. He was the smartest person in the room because he was in the third year of law school when he was arrested. So he had, you know, years and years of being on death row in Florida. That's where that was. And it was, like, right before his final, you know, appeal was running out. Like, in December of 88, he was executed in January of 89 in Florida at Stark there on death row. And by that point, he had been on death row for almost 20 years. I mean, and he already knew the law when he was arrested. So he knew the law better than any lawyer in the room. Much better. And he was smart, and he was charming, and he was very personable, and he could be anybody. And that's what I found with not everyone looks like Charles Manson. Some of them do, but most of them don't. And then when you're sitting there, you're thinking, you know, he can be anyone. And I'm able to really separate the crime from the person. And in order to get them to talk to you, because what's in it for someone sitting on death row to talk to you? They got a life sentence on their head. Why talk to somebody that's not a lawyer? Why, that's not their lawyer. That's not getting them. Why do it? Because you have to kind of side with them. You must do that or they will not talk to you. You know, you're a dirty bastard. You did this. You did that. They're going to shut down. So you have to find something about them that you like, that you see that you like, and that's what you play on that. You can't just be all negative when you go in. It's not going to work, and that's what I'm able to do. I'm able to say, there's different killers. I mean, he was a serial killer. Okay,
right.
That's there's a very small percent of murderers out there that are serial killers that just kill because it's the thrill for them. I mean, there's a whole thing with him. He was a necrophiliac, and that was part of the reason why he killed them and then had sex with the corpses after he killed them. It's either that or work in a mortuary, which he tried to do. He always was applying for jobs at mortuaries because he knew he was
Thomas,
an ex-celia.
I find this whole thing so fascinating. I really, really do. As a child, I used to go to work with my mother on Saturdays. She worked for the district attorney of Manhattan. And in her criminal building, they had what they called the tombs downstairs, where all the prisoners would be brought on a bus. And as a kid, I would go down there. I would take the elevator, and I'd go downstairs, and I'd go around the back, and I'd watch these prisoners being brought in on a bus, and it was just fascinating. And as I grew up, and now I'm a senior, but I always thought, what a fascinating life that must be.
I think it's interesting. I mean, it's a lot more interesting to sit down with someone like Scott Peterson and Charles Manson and have a chat with them than it is someone that works in Walmart. No offense to somebody that works in Walmart.
I work
but
there.
I just find it, a little more interesting to see what Charles Manson's thinking or what Scotty Boy there at San Quentin is thinking. I find it more interesting. You got to like what you do or it's not going to come out well, I believe. I'm really lucky that way. I get to do what I just really love doing. And having, I'm a poor starving writer at heart, so there's a lot of times, especially with the advent of the internet, it's really destroyed. The publishing industry has really taken a hit, but you got to just love what you do, and I do. It's just fascinating to me. It's scary and fascinating at the same time, especially when you're on death row. It's very scary. It's a very scary
thing. Let me ask you this, Donna. When Ted Bundy was on death row, you said he was on death row for 20 years or 20-plus years?
About 20 years, yes.
Okay, let me ask you this. Was it already decided from the beginning that he was going to be executed, or did he keep getting appeals and going through this and doing
appeals.
That? But
he
it was already determined.
And getting stays. He would get stays of execution. Like the governor of Florida would grant him a stay. His lawyers would come up with something, and they would give him a stay. You know, he wanted – a lot of them – you know, want to live. I mean, they claim that they don't care and blah, 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 but they try everything at the last minute. I'll give somebody some credit. Eileen Wuornos, remember her? She's one of the only female serial killers in the United States.
Right.
She asked for this. I mean, she said, listen, there's no use in keeping me here because if you let me out, I'm going to kill again and
kill
I want to die.
Yeah.
I don't want to be here anymore. And there's some that ask to be killed on a certain day, like on their mother's birthday, or to screw up their mother's birthday for the rest of their life. There's a lot, and they give it to them. They let them be executed on their mother's birthday. I don't know if you knew that. They do it in some places, in some states.
Wow.
Or of someone they hate, like the father, or whoever, their ex-wife, let's do it on her birthday. You know what I mean? Just to do more psychological damage. They're very deviant, a lot of these people. And that's why, yes, to get back to the question, that's why he languished for 20 years. And, you know, they have nothing to do. They're sitting in their cells 23 hours a day on death row with nothing but time on their hands. So they can write beautiful legal briefs, especially
right.
him. He was a third-year law student when he was arrested. He knew the law. By the time he was arrested, I mean, judges that he stood before said it's a shame. The one in Florida said, if you would have went another way, you would have been a great lawyer, because in some of the cases he defended himself. He was great. He would have been a wonderful lawyer. He was very, very articulate, and one of the smartest ones out of all of them that I've ever interviewed was him.
Did he ever mention
Scott
what
Peterson,
made him? Did he ever mention what made him start the killing spree?
He was a necrophiliac. That's why. Well, what made him actually do it is that he had a girlfriend when he was in college at the University of Washington, because he was from the Seattle area, Puget Sound
mm-hmm.
there, and she dumped mm-hmm. him. And she had long brown hair parted in the middle. Every single woman that he killed had long brown hair parted in the middle.
Wow.
That's what the theory is. He wouldn't admit to, I mean, they're not going to admit to every little thing, but the theory was that he was angry that she dumped him, and that's because it's too weird that every single victim had long brown hair parted in the middle. That's just too strange, right, that they all had long brown hair parted in the middle. When you look at all the different color hair people have and hairstyles, they all looked alike, all of them. I mean, people were dyeing their hair when he was on the run. People that had brown hair were dyeing it blonde just because he was on the run. Because they knew a lot of the victims had long brown hair parted in the middle. I don't know if you remember the case. It was in the 70s. When
yeah,
he was
vaguely
missing.
Remember
he escaped
it.
In Colorado twice he escaped. You know, it was interesting, too, with him. I think internally he knew that he had a beast inside of him that couldn't be stopped, and he wanted to be stopped, because when he was in Colorado, he was in Aspen, Colorado. He was being interviewed by someone that he knew in Washington that was a friend of his, but also a reporter. He goes, you know, if I was to be executed, in what state do you think that they carried out, most likely to carry it out, in which state? And the guy told him Florida. Now, that he was sitting in Colorado when he told him that. He escaped. He went to Gainesville, Florida, got on a bus, then got on a plane, went to Gainesville, Florida, killed all those girls at the sorority house, and then was caught in Florida. Now, that's just too weird that somebody, he asked which state and then goes to Florida. Like in Colorado, if he would have stayed there, it's very rare to be executed there. They don't carry it out commonly. Texas and Florida is where they come. So that's kind of weird that he would go. It's like he wanted to be caught and he wanted to be stopped, or else he wouldn't have gone there. I mean, that's what
wow.
I think.
Wow. That is really something. So
that's
did you go to
the
execution?
Thing with Berkowitz.
With who?
With Berkowitz in New York, he was killing girls with certain color hair, and they were changing the color of their hair. And then he still killed the girl with the blonde hair.
No, but
when
Ted
Berkowitz,
didn't. All of his victims had.
No, I know Ted didn't.
Had,
I'm saying,
yeah,
but that
Ted
was
didn't.
A thing
yeah.
in New York.
No, that's
with
interesting.
Berkowitz.
Maybe
yeah.
someone made him mad. And I don't know. I'm not familiar with
Son
her.
Of Sam.
Son of Sam. I'm not familiar
yeah.
because I've never interviewed him, so that I can't
oh, okay.
speak to.
Mm-hmm.
Since I don't know, you know, I don't. I mean, I deal with the ones I interview. Can't get them
uh-huh.
all. I wish I could get them all. Another one I'm talking to right now that you might enjoy on this show is Jodi Arias. I'm
oh.
dealing with her. Do you know who she is?
Mm-hmm. That's the one who killed her boyfriend,
in Arizona,
stabbed him and shot him.
Mm-hmm. Stabbed him 27 times and slit his throat, Travis
mm-hmm.
Alexander. I've been interviewing
okay.
her. She's going through her second trial now for the penalty phase. She's already in Arizona. She's already been convicted of first-degree premeditated murder. Now they're arguing whether it's going to be life without parole or the death penalty, and they do execute in Arizona. So I've been communicating with her. I'm going to probably do a piece on her at some point when this part of her, because the last trial that she had last year, the jury hung on the penalty. They couldn't come
mm-hmm.
to a decision versus whether it was life or death, so now they're redoing the penalty phase only. She's already been convicted because she claimed
wow.
it was self-defense. That's why she did it. I mean, if that's not, I mean, you're going to kill someone in self-defense and slit their throat and kill them and
mm-hmm.
shoot them and
yeah.
it's self-defense. Okay.
Wow.
Right. I'm not going to say anything on that because she's still going through
right.
her penalty. But so it doesn't really matter. You know, if it was me, I've spent a lot of time on death row with these inmates. if it was me, and I'm just a visitor there, and it's bad enough being a visitor, and if I would ask to be executed too, just like I wouldn't want to be in there. I just wouldn't. I would rather be dead than be in there. That's just my personal opinion. I wouldn't
try to.
It's easy to say unless you're faced with it. But I've been to death row a lot, and I can tell you one thing. That San Quentin, for instance, which is the largest death row in the United States, as I've seen Richard Ramirez. He was one of the scariest, cold-blooded killers that I've ever encountered in my life. He died last year of natural causes.
Did
the whole thing. Yeah, he died last year after being on death row for 25 years. He died. Most people in California that are on death row, because it's such a crowded death row, actually either die of natural causes, somebody kills, you know, they're not actually executed. There's over 800 men and 47 women on death row in California, and they must, it's an automatic appeal when someone's sentenced to death. So they had, and the appeal is so bogged down, and now it's tabled because there's a new law that it has to be a doctor that does the execution, and no doctor's going to do it because then they're going to get sued. So I don't think it's going to be a long time unless they change the law completely where we'll see another execute. At the last one that I saw right before he was executed, I saw him down there, was Stanley Tookie Williams. Remember him? He founded one of the Jamie Foxx played him in a movie, and I saw Jamie leaving. I was going in to visit Scott Peterson. Yeah, it's a busy place there.
Scott Peterson, oh, my God.
I was going in to visit Scott Peterson, and Jamie, there was a big demonstration, because I'm very against the death penalty. There was a big demonstration outside against him being executed, and Tupac was out there speaking against, you know. Everybody and their mother was out there, and I was getting in to go visit Scott Peterson, and I saw Jamie came out. He just came to visit Stanley. It's like a subculture when you're in this kind of stuff, you know, dealing with high-profile criminals. And I saw Jamie come out, and, I mean, he already played him in the movie, you know. He already did the film about him, and so he was visiting him, like, the last few days that he was alive. And I told him, I said, your movie that you did of Stanley, and I got to visit Stanley a few times and talk to him, was the most accurate portrayal of death row that I've ever seen. It was he was so good in that film, and he goes, oh, thank you, and I gave him a hug, and he was just so sad. It was sad, though, because, you know, he was died a few days. He was executed a few days after that.
Right.
And I don't know about what anybody else. It's a very personal thing to death. I don't think anybody is thinking of the death penalty when they murder somebody. It doesn't stop people from murdering people. It costs the taxpayers a lot of money. And let's say the person is innocent. Okay, and it's been proven with DNA many people on death row are innocent, okay? So there's nothing you can do if you execute the wrong person. I'm just very against the death penalty. That's just my personal opinion.
Yes, I am too.
I think it solves anything.
So am I.
Because the simple fact, somebody innocent, and I believe there's been a lot of innocent people that have been put to death, you know, just like this, I don't know how long, but it was a 14-year-old boy. I can't think of his name. A 14-year-old African-American little boy. He was executed, and he was so small they had to set him on books to put him in an electric chair. And now, now after all these years, he's been exonerated. But he's
dead. And he's gone. But the family will own the state. You see, and it costs so much money. I mean, it costs it's all taxpayer money that pays for the appeal process. It doesn't solve anything. It really doesn't. I would be maybe for it if it would stop people, but it doesn't. People that do this kind of stuff think they're not going to get caught. They really do. They don't say, oh, I might get executed. I'm not going to do it. It doesn't stop someone from doing it. You see what I mean? So what it's supposed to do, if it's just about vengeance, I mean, I believe it's wrong to take someone's life, no matter who's doing it, whether it's Stanley or I don't know, he claims he was it, or Scott, no matter who's taking someone's life, or the state of California or the state of Florida, I think it's wrong to kill. You don't say it's wrong to kill, and then our answer is we're going to kill you. That just doesn't make sense to me.
No, it doesn't.
I just think it's wrong.
I mean, if a person... Because, see, it's gotten so out of proportion with the fact that you don't know whether a person is innocent or guilty. But if a person admits to their guilt and someone witnessed
like
a murder.
Like Eileen Wuornos, for instance, she admitted, she killed seven men and admitted to doing
right,
it.
Right.
And
now,
she admitted
that may be
warned no
someone
doubt
to be put
she,
to death. Right.
There's no doubt
but,
in her case that she did those crimes. I feel a lot
right.
less bad for her because she wanted, she really wanted to be executed.
She had a sad life anyway. Her
very,
life
oh,
was
she
really,
had a very sad, sad, tragic
yes.
life. It was, she was doomed
yeah,
at birth. My
so
opinion.
I guess she
yeah.
felt that she it wasn't even worth living, you know, so... And, you know, that's mainly why she was doing what she was doing anyway, because her life was so tragic. And it was really, that movie was really sad. And I saw the bio
Theron
of it as well.
Yeah.
And, it, you
she
know,
was
it's just sad how
that,
some
no.
people succumb to killing other people because of things that happened to them, you
mm-hmm,
know.
Mm-hmm. Post-traumatic.
Yeah, that's really sad. Okay, so you also interviewed Charles Manson. He's been locked up for, how many years has he been locked
Ooh,
up?
1971. He was arrested in 1971.
Wow, he's been locked up 43 years.
And I've also interviewed
years.
Some of the Manson girls. Yeah, I've also interviewed Leslie Van Houten, which is
mm-hmm.
one of the Manson girls. And
he's the only
Kremwinkle.
One that's still locked up, isn't
Patricia
he?
Patricia Kremwinkle is also locked up, the two of them. I've interviewed both of them.
Oh, they're still locked
yes.
up.
Yeah, they're both, oh. they're really, I mean, I think it's wrong that they're still locked up, but others say no. I mean, you
wow.
know, in California, we don't have it in every state, but in California, the victim's family can go to the parole
mm-hmm.
hearings and, you know, just weigh in. And it's not allowed in a lot of states, but they do allow it in California. I don't know. I think that when somebody pays the price for, you know, in
right.
Charlie's case, he would probably murder again if he got out.
Although yeah,
I asked him once, I said, you know, Charlie, because he's sitting there smoking pot, you know, and tending to his garden. He's up in Corcoran. He used to be at San Quentin, but then California for a short time reversed the death penalty, and then he got out, and they transferred him to Corcoran. And he's very low minimal, you know, he's in his 70s now, very low minimal, almost 80, he's like 78 or something, or 77.
Mm-hmm.
He's very low, you know, security. He's not like a maximum security. He's not on death row. He's got life without parole because California reverted the death penalty, and then they reverted for him. So all of them got life without parole, all of them that had the death penalty with his mess there. But now it's back on the table, so... There is a death row. So when it was reversed, they moved him to Corcoran, where Sirhan is, the one that killed, they say killed Robert Kennedy.
They say.
I don't know about that.
Right.
They
mm-hmm.
say. He claims he has no memory of doing it, but okay. He doesn't talk very much. That's how he stayed alive.
I moved to California when Manson did that, and I was trying to get out of New York because of Son of Sam. And then I moved to California where my brother is, and then they had the Hillside Strangling Manson. I'm like, what the heck is this?
They've had a lot more since then. We just have a lot here. There's been quite a lot. I also interviewed Lyle and Eric Menendez. Remember them? The
oh,
Menendez
really?
Brothers.
Yes. The
oh,
two
yeah.
that killed their
yeah.
parents.
Wow.
I know they're still
exactly.
locked. They got the death penalty, didn't they?
No, they have life without
no.
parole there. And they're in different prisons. They're not allowed to see each other or talk to each other at all. And they're in
too.
Different prisons. Excuse
wow,
me?
That was a sad
didn't
situation.
They get a couple of
and another one that I interviewed, if you remember, Betty Broderick, the one that killed her
oh,
husband.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
yeah.
yeah. And his wife.
She's
still, yeah.
Now, I really, yeah, and his new wife, I really do believe that she should be out already. She's been
too.
Eligible for parole for at least 10 years already, and she keeps getting
I do
denied. Because they got her on second-degree murder. She was not convicted of first-degree felony murder. It was second-degree murder.
Wow.
I just think she snapped, and she just lost it. And
yeah.
I really don't think that she would go out and do any kind of, you know.
And he sort of like, you know, he was on her a lot, you know. And
he
I
was.
Think he had a lot to do with her cracking up. I really do.
And, you know, he
her
was
husband.
A very powerful attorney in San Diego.
Yes.
And, you know,
yes.
he used that to get at her when they were divorcing. He did. He used his power and his leverage
oh,
against
yeah.
her. I never want to bastardize anybody in death. I don't do that. But I also, and I've gotten a lot of heat for that, don't. Do revisionist history with the victim. That's this current book, because I knew the victim in this case, and he was a horrible bastard that I couldn't stand. I loathed him. I loathed him in life. Should I take the book? And then, you know, it's a moral conundrum a lot of times. Should I take the book? Okay, he was murdered. No excuse to murder somebody. I didn't like him. I stayed away from him. Okay, that's what you generally do when you don't like somebody. Okay, so do you just reverse everything and say they were a saint? No, I don't do that, because he wasn't. You know, he was not a nice person, and I didn't like him. He didn't deserve to have what happened to him, because it was the worst. what happened to him, and I say that in the book. But I'm also not, and I get a lot of heat for that because I refuse to write lies and just make make it like they were saying. I will not do that. I don't think it's right to do that. In the Scott Peterson case too, because I wrote a book. My last book was about Scott Peterson, and you know about that case where he murdered Lacey. Okay, so the public, I was the only one also that wrote a book about that case that actually saw him at San Quentin. None of the other books written about him, I knew him before, during, and after those crimes. None of the other books written about him did anybody ever see him at San Quentin. So that's, but in that case, the way it, when it was playing out and she was missing, do you guys remember that when she was missing? Because she went missing December 2002. It's already been, it's
right
already
before
been
Christmas.
Right, Christmas Eve, but they didn't find her body until April of 2003. So he was he was not arrested until after the bodies were found, her and the baby, because she was like 8 months pregnant. And the public was saying they were the perfect couple and everything was wonderful.
Yeah.
You know, once you see someone says that, you know it's not true because there is no such thing, first of all. The perfect couple. So they were the perfect couple, and then he just kills her the next day. They were the Does that make sense? I mean, is that... Is that you know, and I knew a lot of the truth
there.
I had access to him. I knew him before. I met her once, Lacey. So I knew all of it. I knew the truth. So here's the moral conundrum there. Do you write that, even though everybody is saying one thing, when you know I wrote the other thing? I got heat for it, but I don't care. It's the truth. And
so
I'm not going to ever.
He's
got life without parole. He's on death row at San Quentin. You know, he's been in March. It'll be 10 years that he's at San Quentin already.
Wow.
He was 30 when he was arrested, and he's now 42. He'll be 43 in October.
Wow.
Time just flies, doesn't it?
The movie Gone Girl, was that based off of...
I think so. They don't say that, but it's very similar, isn't it? Yeah, I think so. It's very similar. It wasn't perfect. It's interesting in that case because with Lacey... her first serious boyfriend that she had before, Scott, was his name was Kent Gaines, and he spent many years, he just got out of prison, he spent many years in prison for shooting his girlfriend in the back. Grace Ho was her name. He shot her in the back during an argument, and he spent 15 years in prison. He didn't kill her, but he spent 15 years in prison. What did Scott and Kent Gaines have in common? They were both tall and very nice-looking. And Lacey had a degree, and I didn't even know you could get a degree from Santa Luis Episcopal Polytechnic College. They both had a degree. That's how they met, Scott and Lacey. They met in college. She had a degree in ornamental horticulture. Do you know what that is, you guys? I never even knew you could get a degree in that. It's to beautify things artificially, like with flowers and things. She had a bachelor's degree in that. So that should tell you a lot about how she thought, what was important. Scott looked good. He was tall and he was very nice.
He was a mama's
boy. Took good, but he was cheated. You think Amber Fry was the reason why? I mean, Amber Fry was symbolic of a lot of things. There was 100 Amber Frys. He wasn't going to kill his wife because of Amber Fry. I mean, there was a lot of Amber Fry. He was always cheating on her. He was never faithful to her. So that's why when I saw perfect couple, I thought, you know, I really believe that Scott was innocent, too, in the beginning. I always believed that he was innocent because he told
me. Yeah, because he got on there crying, help me find my
wife.
Well,
no, and the Scott that I knew was incapable of doing that. Just because he was cheating on her all the time, that doesn't make you a killer. And he actually had a very no criminal record, none, not even a parking ticket, never used profanity. Always told me I had terrible potty mouth. You know, never used profanity. He was literally the boy next door. So he was telling me, no, Donna, I did not do it, and I believed him. And when I was trying to help him, I was going to write a book discussing all the variables of the book because they didn't have any, you know, DNA that tied him to that. They had no eyewitnesses. He was denying it publicly. But he slipped one day when I was visiting him at San Quentin. He slipped in something he said, and then I knew that he was guilty at that point. And that's why the title of that book is I'm Sorry I Lied to You, because it was over his lies that he told me. It was a direct quote. That's how I got the title of that book, I'm Sorry I Lied. And then he told me everything that he did when we were sitting. And as a matter of fact, I was going to testify against him in the civil trial that Lacey's mother, Sharon Rocha, was bringing forward she was going to have after he was convicted and sent to death row, she was going to have a civil trial to get him for wrongful death so she could get money. But then she figured, well, and I was going to testify against him because of the book and because he can, mm-hmm. because of everything I found out. But then she called, you know, she dropped the suit because she figured, well, you know, he's on death row. He has no money. There's no purpose to sue him. She was just angry, you know. She just wanted to do everything that she could. So that, but then at the last minute, she, and I was glad because I didn't want to have to go be involved in that circus, you know, in court and do that. It's not pleasant to have to go and do that. So I was glad it would stop. But he's never getting out. You know, that's the problem with these, for a defendant. In his case, I'm glad that he's guilty, and I'm glad that he's where he's supposed to be, because I don't think his trial was fair, even though he's guilty. So, and I was part of a documentary about how true crime, how high-profile crime cases are treated in the criminal justice, how they don't get the same kind, because they knew everything about him before he stepped forth in the courtroom. They knew, they heard the tapes between him and Amber Fry. They knew he was a cheating piece of crap. I mean, how's a jury going to look at him when they know all of these prejudicial things, you know, ahead of time? You know, it's not supposed to be like that. And so I knew that he didn't have a fair trial, but I'm glad at least in his case he had an unfair trial, but he's really guilty, so he deserves to be where he is anyway, even though his trial was not fair. And I still don't think his trial was fair, and it wasn't.
But he was
not to have all of that stuff on the table about someone when, and they knew everything. You know that. When you sit for a jury, you're not supposed to have even heard of the case before.
Well, it's up to the judge to throw it out or keep it in, isn't it?
No, but, you know, it was in Medez. They moved the trial to Redwood City, and, you know, that was 90 miles away from Medez. But the time he was arrested, because he wasn't arrested for 5-6 months, it was on the news constantly, that case.
Oh,
it was
yeah.
on the cover of People. It was all over. Everyone heard of it all over the country, let alone right there in California where it was coming out of. Everyone in every state knew. Where would they have moved it? To Canada? They would have had to move it out of the United States for him to have a fair trial, really. And they don't do that, mm-hmm. so he wasn't going to get a fair trial, in my opinion.
Right.
I mean, in England, they're not allowed to do that. It's really interesting. They don't have the death penalty there, but they're not allowed to do that. They're not allowed to talk about a case. I don't know if you guys know that. They can't do that. They can't get on TV and talk about a case every second before someone's
it
gone
used to be
trial.
That
they're not allowed
years,
to do that in
ago.
England.
Yeah,
so
I thought it was like
that there.
Everywhere.
No, they're not allowed to do that there, because how can the person have a fair trial if they're doing that?
Right.
And you got, you know, pundits getting on TV and speculating and talking about every little thing. There's no way it's going to be fair when they're doing that.
Why
and the jury, you know, sitting there. And that was not a sequester jury. It was, I think, at a certain point, but initially it wasn't. And, you know, in Jody Arias' case, it was not a sequester jury either. They were going home every night. You tell me that they're not watching TV. They're not getting on their phone doing email. How can you avoid, with the technology that we have now, not to see things in the media, that, you know, when you're allowed to have a smartphone, how can you avoid it? I don't know how you could. I don't know how that's possible. See, and they were dissecting her case quite a bit too. I don't really think her trial was fair either, because of all of the publicity that it was received, and she's guilty. But her trial wasn't fair. There was just too much media attention on it. And she's a very nice person, by the way. You know, when you just talk to her and have a chat with her, she's very smart, really smart. And now that we're talking about, you know, dates and things, I'll give you some interesting trivia. Her birthday is July 9th, Jody Arias is. OJ's is July 9th. Amanda Knox is July 9th. Chris Porco, that killed his father and permanently injured, is July 9th. So now when you go and meet somebody, make sure that their birthday is not July 9th.
Thank you.
July is a pretty dangerous month.
July 9th, that's a bad day. July 9th, bad, very bad. Isn't that strange?
Well, we're going to take a quick
that
break.
All of them have
we'll
July
be...
9th.
We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back with our wonderful special guest this evening, Donna Thomas. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Bringing Sexy Back, right here on Delicious Talk Radio. There is no religion or politics spoken here, only delicious adult conversation. Audience participation is encouraged, so log in and create an account to engage in conversation in our chat room. Feel free to call in with your questions and comments. at 646-652-2877. That's 646-652-2877. And let's get this delicious talk conversation going.
You got to do these contractual.
You whisper sad. Don't be discouraged, though I realize it's hard to take courage in a world full of people. You can lose sight of it all in the darkness there inside you, makes you feel so small. But I see your true
Listen up. I got to tell you about this beautiful author and publisher, Gail Delicious Johnson. Gail Delicious Johnson is proud to announce the publication of her new revised issue of her latest suspenseful novel, Back to Zero. Read this riveting story of intrigue, conflict, love, and suspense. Follow the trail of abuse, secrets, lies, and love. And check it out. You can't just read the back of the book, because you have to prepare yourself for the mind-blowing, explosive ending. Order your personally autographed copy of Back to Zero by visiting www.jjpublishing.com. That's www.jayjaypublishing.com. Back to Zero is a fictional story with a dash of reality. It's a tale about Anthony Thomas, a man who lost the most precious things in his life, starting with his first childhood love, Gloria. Tragedy soon followed after losing his mom to cancer, and shortly thereafter, he lost his wife, Lynn, and son, Junior, in a horrific car crash. With each traumatic incident, Anthony was branded, sending him back to zero. 30 years later, Anthony runs into Gloria, and the flames in their hearts are still burning. Gloria, now a law enforcement official who also comes with baggage, a psychotic husband named Wayne Anderson who is out of control. He, too, is a law enforcement official that's abusive, jealous, and an alcoholic. Wayne treats Gloria miserable. While snooping behind his wife, he finds out that she had research information concerning Anthony on the internet. Wayne goes into a rage of madness like a rabid dog because in his sick, twisted mind, he feels threatened and accuses Gloria of sleeping with Anthony. Often, he would evict her from the house, but not realizing the night would come when he forces his wife straight into the arms of Anthony. After spending an intense, earth-shattering night of lovemaking, Gloria opens up and confesses to Anthony that she still loves him. Rekindling their relationship is dangerous, and Wayne will stop at nothing to make his wife and her first love's life a miserable hell while fighting his own demons. Wayne harbors a deep, dark, and deadly secret, one he thought he and only the devil knew. Find out what happens when Gloria uncovers the truth about her abusive, lawless husband's mysterious past. The devastation will bring the three of them together in an explosive confrontation. Find out the shocking secrets Wayne harbored and prepare yourself for who will pay the ultimate price for his lawless actions. Gail Delicious Johnson says, Back to Zero will take you where the law becomes the abuser. Order this fast-paced, action-packed, filled drama by best-selling author Gail Delicious Johnson from her web store at JJ Publishing. That's J-A-Y-J-A-Y Publishing.com. Remember, abuse is never an option.
All righty, we're back at Delicious Talk Radio. I'm your host, Gail Delicious Johnson, along with my co-host, Terry, and my other co-host, Jadino, and our special guest this evening, Donna Thompson. We're talking about her writing career as a true crime writer. We discussed Richard Ramirez, Charles Manson, Scott Peterson, and a host of other crime people that she interviewed. And the show is very interesting. So if anybody has any questions or comments, feel free to call in. The call-in number is 646-652-2877. And Jadino, did you have any questions or comments that you wanted to make with Donna?
No, I just was listening in because I know I follow a lot of movies, and it's always like I don't ever think I have a thing about being a lawyer, but I always figure the movie out way before everybody else. I just don't say that, but or like I'm with my wife, she'd be like, "Don't tell me. I already know you know who the killer is." So she wants to see. I think the one she mentioned about Gone Girl or whatever the one was with the.
Right, Gone Girl.
Yeah, but that's not true, though. That's a fiction movie.
I know it's not true, but I mean, like, I read a lot of books on serial killers and because the way their minds work or whatever.
Right.
Always had an interest in that.
In my current book, intended for mature audience, the piece I wrote about the adult film star Kenneth E. Boham, and his stage name was Marcus Allen. He's a white guy. I just want you to, you know, because he took the stage name purposely because he thought of it. I asked him, why'd you take Marcus Allen's name? And he goes, well, you know, because he didn't want, you know, he was like, he didn't want to do it. He did it like he had a kid to feed. He goes, I was hoping, like, I love Marcus Allen. I was hoping to just get in, make some money, and get out quick like Marcus Allen did. That's mm-hmm. what I was hoping. So that's why he picked the name Marcus Allen, because he just always loved Marcus Allen. So he took his name. But, you know, in that case, the way that it ends up in court and the way the case plays itself out, the trial, that will mm-hmm. really surprise you what happens at the end part, how it all ended and how the defense went. Right, Gail, don't you think? I mean, you read the book.
Yeah.
What do you think?
Yeah. Yeah, it was very surprising to me.
Exactly.
Very.
So,
I'm not going to
give
anything
give that away.
But
it's...
Right.
Right.
But
very
do you
surprising.
Have the book so you can maybe read an excerpt from it for us?
Yeah, I do.
Okay.
Okay. Well, you know, I think that, you know, this is a story about an adult film star that I didn't know prior to the murder, who murdered somebody in Denver that I once worked for. He murdered a man named J.P. Kelso that was openly gay, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And it was about, you know, that they were involved in an intimate relationship once Timothy was out of the porn business. But, you know, a lot of things that were being said, a lot of things the media and people kind of have a tendency to twist the truth, especially in crime cases where it's good versus bad. And a lot of times it's just not that way. A lot of times it's just evil and some more evil. Sometimes.
Right.
And in this case, that's what it is to me more. And I'm speaking about this because when I write a book, about it, even an article, when I write about a true crime case, I have to either have direct access to the defendant or the victim. You always the defendant. But in this case,
right.
It was so much better because I knew the victim. And I don't get
wow.
that opportunity most of the time. I'm just writing it from my experiences with the defendant. And in this case, when they were saying, I mean, even when he was lying, because he's a pathological liar, the porno, mm-hmm. Tim is, when he was saying things about, when I was interviewing and he was saying things the way it went down and he said things, I just knew certain things were lies because I knew the victim. So I knew certain things that he was saying was just not so because I knew the man. And I just knew it was just not true. So I had that advantage. And you'll see that a lot throughout the book. I mean, he says one thing to the police and to his lawyers and in court, and then I'm saying what really is the truth based on what I personally know. Not what I think, what I know. And there's a difference between
right.
what somebody thinks and
what
they
know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, he's grew up in a very small place. Tim did, Stewart, Nebraska. You guys are on the East Coast. Can you imagine growing up in a town of 4,000 people and then ending up, you know, being a porno star? I mean, his
wow.
family, I know you don't discuss religion, but they were very religious people. He was raised with a lot of, you know, religion, and that was an issue for him. I mean, it's like the epic tale of what not to do when you raise your children. Mm-hmm. You know, he said he felt very stifled by the religion. And so he, you know, goes to L.A. He winds up impregnating a girl, an African-American girl, actually, that he met in high school in Nebraska, which was very, very, very few African-Americans in that part of the country, even now, then
wow.
even less. So that was, like, really frowned upon by his family. He met a girl in high school. He always felt very alienated from everybody. He loved the theater. He was drawn to the theater, and he just always felt different. Really nice looking kid. You see his picture? I mean, he's very good looking. And just
yeah.
felt very alienated, was teased in school constantly. So he found this girl. He fell in love with her, his high school sweetheart. She was African American. He didn't care. I mean, he's, you
mm-hmm.
know, was about as open minded. He loved her, and she had a drug problem, and, you know, and she became pregnant. And they had a baby, a girl, and shortly after childbirth, and this is when he's shortly out of high school when this is going on, shortly
mm-hmm.
after childbirth, the girlfriend dies from
mm-hmm.
a drug-related overdose, and he, at 19,
mm-hmm.
is left with this child to raise. That's how
mm-hmm.
he ends up doing the porn. I mean, that's what he says. And I believe
mm-hmm.
that to be so, because I believe that if he had never had a child, we don't want to blame the child, but I do believe he would have made different choices had he not been a single father at 19. I think his choices would have been different. There's no excusing what went on here or what he did or what he didn't do, but I just think that just the course of events, having the child and him having very little support from the family. And I believe, and I met his family. I spent a lot of time with his mother. I was on a TV show with his mother because I felt that I needed to tell the story a little bit because I knew the victim in this case. And I was starting to do the research and visiting him in prison and interviewing him because I was going to write a book about the case, obviously, because I was writing about true crime already and I knew the victim in this case. So I reached out to him when he was arrested and said, you know, by the way, I'm a writer, but I knew the victim, so if I can help you in any way. And that's how I started to get access to him. But, you know, I believe that there was a lot of things at play here. He had this biracial child. They didn't approve it. They were very disapproving of that. They did not like it. They didn't give him the support that he needed. I think the family holds a lot of guilt now after the fact. And his mother personally told me if she could have changed things back then, she would have. None of us have a crystal ball. I mean, she's consumed with guilt. It's a very sad, tragic tale, this story. It's just lose-lose all around the board.
Yes.
And the biggest victim in the whole story is the child, is his daughter, in my opinion, because she just lost everything through this with no parents. It's just really,
and she's in the
really,
care of
really
who?
Sad. It's really sad, in my opinion. It's one of the saddest cases that I've ever worked on because she just had no, I mean, it's an innocent child, you know, and she lost so much. And she was a beautiful little child. I got to meet her. Beautiful little girl. And, you know, she's being raised by somebody that is not biologically related to her. And the person that is raising her is the person that got him started in the porn business. He's raising the child.
Goodness.
He legally adopted the daughter. So it says it's really sad when you look at that, all the collateral damage in this case.
Wow.
Horrible. It's a horrible, horrible story.
How old is the little girl at this particular time?
She's 13 now. 13 years old. But sad. It's really, really sad. Hopefully,
and the grandmother won't take her?
They wouldn't take her. They did. You know, the grandmother said, I didn't want him to. The grandmother said, his mother wanted him to give the daughter up for adoption because the mother was died. You know, the girl's mother didn't want her either. That's another thing.
Wow.
Okay, so the girl's mother didn't. She had a parents and a family. They didn't want her either. No one stepped up to the plate in this story. Neither side did. Just that was available to them, and he didn't get any help from the girl's family either. He didn't get any help. He was on his own with that child when he was 19. Mm. That's a lot. That's a lot of respect. It's a lot for women, and women are more nurturing by nature. A 19-year-old kid, I will give him credit. I mean, he didn't run. A lot of them would have ran and not taken any responsibility for the child, and he didn't do that. He made all the wrong choices. Every wrong choice that you can possibly make, he made. But he did it because he wanted to support his child.
Right.
And I've gotten a lot of slack. Well, he shouldn't be. But that was the reason why he did it. And I do believe that he wouldn't have ended up where he ended up had he not had a child at 19. I do believe his life would have been very different. I don't think you and I would be talking about this case if he didn't have a child at 19. I really don't. I think his life would have been different. It's just so sad to me. It's
really just a sad
story because, you know, I looked at him and I told you before I was able to separate. I'm very able to separate what they did from the person that they are. And he was really a nice kid. When you got down to it and you took away the porn and you just sat there and you just chatted with him, he was a very pleasant, nice young man. He really was. He could have been anyone's brother. Literally the boy next door, that's what he could have been sitting there. You would have never known that he had been this huge porn star. I mean, he was on the cover of Playgirl magazine when he was arrested. So he made it huge, high up the ladder in the porn industry. After I did the television show, which was on PBS with his mother in Colorado, it didn't even air nationally, I got fan mail from his fan base from all over the world. People would write to me Say, tell Marcus that we're praying for him. That, you know, he had, they, I never knew that. I didn't know very little to nothing about the porn business before, but I know a lot about it. I know everything about it now. But he had a fan base like a rock star does. They have a huge fan base. I've had many conversations about the porn industry, too, as a result of this book. A lot of people, there's a lot of shaming that goes on with these porn performers. Well, you know, it's a multi-billion dollar industry. Okay, if people wouldn't be watching the porn, then there wouldn't be a need to have the porn actors there, right? So, I mean, when there's a lot of shaming that goes on, who's worse, the one that watches it or the one that does, performs in it?
Wow.
I mean, if you really want to start throwing stones at people.
Well, I don't think
it's a multi, but I get a lot of that because of what the subject matter is of this particular book.
I think they're closet porn people. The ones that give you the smack, I really do. I think they're closeted.
The ones that watch it, right? Don't you think?
Yes.
I mean, if no one watched it, then there'd be no industry. It's a multi-billion dollar industry worldwide. In this country, it's just, it's all over the place. Everyone, most people that you know watch it. I mean, not every single person, but you know people that watch it. They're not going to admit to, a lot of people don't admit that they watch it, but they do.
That's why they're closeted.
Yeah, it's still billions and billions of dollars are spent on it. And, you know, he was an escort, too, a male escort, before he got into the porn. He was a model at first. He did straight modeling. Then it just wasn't enough money to support his child because he was doing it on his own. Then he started doing became a male escort. And, you know, with escorts, I mean, women don't have to hire escorts. They do it very rarely. If they want sex, they don't have to pay for it. So all of his client base were men. And 95% of his client base were married men. That was another thing. I go into that in the book. I discuss that at great length about certain issues concerning that. So, you know, there's a lot of different issues with this case. And so then he, you know, winds up, it just was by chance that he met Chi Chi LaRue, who's a very prolific pornographer when he was out in L.A. He got his family to cooperate with him and watch Jasmine, his daughter, for 3 months while he tried to make it in L.A. They told him he had to either go to New York or L.A. to make it in the modeling business because he was a successful model locally, regionally, but to really get more money and get more income, he had to either go to New York or L.A. And he went purely to L.A. because it was closer. You know, if you wanted to drive it from Denver to there, it's 1,000 miles, and he could drive it in a car, or, you know, it was just closer to get to it, to go back and forth. So he went to L.A. because it was closer, and he started, you know, going, making his rounds, trying to make it in the mile. And they gave him 3 months, his family did. And that's really not enough time to make it. I know people here that it takes them years. They're waiting tables, they're driving cabs until they make it, the ones that do. 3 months is just really not enough time. And had he not had a kid, he wouldn't have had to go back in 3 months. They gave him a 3-month timetable of watching because he didn't have money to go back and forth. He stayed in L.A. while he made it, and on the third, he had 90 days to make it, and on where he had 3 days left is when he met Chi Chi LaRue. He was walking down Santa Monica Boulevard in West Hollywood. He walked past him, and Chi Chi LaRue, very prolific pornographer in the industry, has handled Jenna Jameson and some of the biggest porn stars in the world. He's produced and made films with Falcon Studios, and he just saw him. Chi Chi LaRue is his alter ego. It's a woman. He dresses up in drag. Chi Chi does. So he was dressed as a man when he saw him walking down the street. And he said, "Are you an actor? Just like you see in the movies, right?" And he goes, "Well, I'm going around doing auditions." And, you know, you see this a lot in L.A. Everybody's an actor, right? The guy that drives a cab is an actor. The one in the restaurant's an actor. He goes, "But I'm not getting anywhere." And he gave him his card. And he goes, "I'm a producer. I make films." "What kind of films do you make?" "I make adult films." He didn't lie. He didn't sugarcoat. He goes, on his card, it said Chi Chi LaRue. I mean, I've heard of Chi Chi LaRue before this case. I knew who he was. And I said to him, "Tim, you never heard of Chi Chi LaRue before?" He goes, "No, I wasn't watching porn. I don't know who he is, and especially that kind of porn. No, I never heard of him. I didn't know who he was." And he said, "I make adult films." And he goes, "I wasn't even sure what he meant by adult films, to be honest with you. I really wasn't positive. I thought it was porn, but maybe not." And he goes, "Well, if you're interested, call me up. We'll go have dinner, and we'll discuss it." And he said he wasn't going to do that. He really didn't want to do that. But then, you know what? He didn't want to go back to Denver defeated. And he said even if he went back to Denver and he didn't make it in L.A., he went back to Denver, he still would have to have a job in Denver to feed his daughter. He had to have a job no matter what city he was living in. So he said he just decided to do it because he didn't want to go back to Denver defeated. So that's what
wow.
he did. That's how he got into the porn. He hated it, every second of it. He hated it. He really did. He had a real hard time. Even though he rose to the ranks, was on the cover of Freshman magazine, won all kinds of porn awards. You know, they have their own version of Oscars in Vegas. They give out awards. Did all of that. Did very well. Had a huge fan base. He hated every second of it. Hated it. Absolutely hated it.
I don't think
there was, you know, AIDS all over the place, HIV, there was people sick, and Chi-Chi goes around saying he's a condom Nazi, that's what he calls himself, that everybody's got to have a condom, and Tim said that's absolutely not true, there was no, like, he never saw a condom on the set, and he also said that when people had lesions, they showed up to the set with lesions, they used makeup, and he looked through the lens, and when they couldn't see the makeup anymore, rolled tape, that's what it was about. He said it was sick. That's what he referred to when he used the word sick. People
wow,
all
you're
around
sort of breaking
sick.
Up.
Oh, that's, can you hear me now?
Yeah, I can hear you now.
He said that that's what it was sick, meaning that they all were ill, like a lot of them had, they were not medically checked like they should have been. There was none of that. He never saw any of that. He said when he was actually arrested and went and arrested and was, you know, processed, he said, just give me an AIDS test. I'm sure I have it. And he had been out of porn for years already. He said that was what surprised him most about his life, that when they checked him for AIDS and HIV, he didn't have it yet. He said, I'm shocked that I don't have it after all that I've gone through.
Wow. That is really sad, you know, especially
it's
with the
really
child
sad.
Being involved, you know, because,
it's terrible.
And then not getting any help from either side of
Nothing.
His family, you know, that's so heartbreaking because that little girl didn't ask to come here. She's here,
no,
you
know,
and got to go through all this
stuff.
She was
a lovely little girl. It's just,
you know,
really sad.
Wow.
And, you know, it was heartbreaking when he was in jail because I saw her after he was in already, and, you know, they would say, and the mother was watching her for short periods of time while she was being, you know, adopted. I mean, they were making arrangements to adopt her while he was in prison and all of that, you know. And I mean, while he was in jail waiting trial. And then after he was, you know, convicted, that was it. That was all she wrote. He had no rights, whether he waived his rights or not. He said he never waived his rights, but that was it, though. They just got a representative ad litem that represented her.
Mm-hmm.
And they just said, he's in prison. He can't raise her. He was convicted, and he cannot raise her, so his rights were waived. But I met, you know, and they would say, "Well, Daddy's at work. Daddy's at work." When he was in jail, you know, being, you know, waiting trial, they would say, "Daddy's at work," and she would say, "Oh, I want to see Dad." I mean, she loved him because until he was arrested, he always, you know, she was almost six at that point, so he always raised her. She was always with him, and she just loved him so much. It was the saddest thing. And she goes, "Oh, I miss Daddy," and she would just sit there and cry. It was the saddest thing.
And so she's with Chi-Chi LaRue now.
No, she's with another one that got him into the escorting, which was the segue into the porn industry. She's in Denver. I don't know still now, but the last I knew,
you're
she was being
up.
Raised in Denver. Oh, she's in Denver being raised by the one that got him in the escorting, and which was a segue for him into the porn business.
Wow. That is really sad. Jay, do you have any questions for Donna? Jade? I guess she has her mute button on. Okay, so are you ready to read an excerpt for us?
Sure. Okay.
Okay.
Okay, this is about, deals with actually the murder. That's in Chapter 9. There are different versions of stories regarding how J.P. Kelso and Tim Bohan met each other. There is Tim's version, the one he told me before the trial. There is the one he told on the witness stand. I believe the truth is closer to the version he told me before the trial. A lot of what he said on the stand was pure fabrication.
cooked up to save his neck and hide from the electric chair. Colorado does have the death penalty, not implemented as often as in other states, but nevertheless it is used. In the before trial version, Tim told me that after he left the porn industry permanently in 2005 and was living in Denver full-time, he was desperately looking for work. Tim recalled that he was sitting in a coffee shop on Colfax Avenue near the Capitol, and he was scouring the one ads in the Denver Post. JP was in, that JP being the victim. JP was in the coffee shop that morning also. The shop must have been only 5 minutes away from JP's downtown office. As Tim was drinking coffee and circling ads, a little fat man approached. JP asked Tim if he was Marcus Allen by any chance. Tim, taken aback by the use of his porn name, said, "No, my name is John," because Tim went by his middle name of John. JP was defiant in his belief that Tim was, in fact, Marcus Allen. Tim assured the stranger standing over him he was not this Marcus Allen. His name really was John, and he was busy. JP asked him if he was looking for work. Tim told JP that yes, he was, in fact, looking for work. He would consider any type of work. JP said, "Great, I have a collection agency." And Tim, always looking for good people, "Well, I don't have any type of experience doing that type of work," Tim told JP. JP told Tim that he should come down to the office and perhaps they would work something out. He gave Tim his business card and told him to call him anytime. Tim called him a few days later, and he went over to PRS, which is Professional Recovery Systems, to talk to JP about working there. Tim has afterwards said publicly that he had a friendship with JP. He claimed after the collection position went south, because he wound up not working there very long, went south, he and JP tried to have a sexual relationship for money, but it didn't work out, so it simply reverted to a friendship. That isn't the truth. All anyone had to do was look at the two of them side by side to know that was a load of horse manure that Tim was trying to sell to save his butt. If he had his second of interaction with JP, money was involved. That second, or in a future second, it is really that simple. Again, it was all about money and Tim's desire to get his hands on it. Tim was a hustler that was constantly eyeing his next prey. JP, as bad as he was lonely and hungered for the attention of young, good-looking men. He would try to attain that attention with money and lavish gifts, anything and everything to win his cherished prizes. He would do without a second thought. So we're talking now, I'm talking about their relationship. Tim said under oath that it was a mutual friend of his and JP's named Dan that encouraged him to go to JP's house and have sex with JP for money. That was for the public. Based on what Tim admitted before the trial, I don't think Tim needed any encouragement to screw someone for money. He had been doing it for years by the time he met JP. Tim had, on a prior occasion, enlisted into the National Guard. He never actually went to any type of basic training. He did take the Armed Services Vocational Battery exam and got the minimal score needed to enlist. He kept putting off actually going off to boot camp. After he was not able to hack the bill collector job at PRS, he was kind of in limbo as far as work and money. He didn't dare cut JP loose, for he knew the man was good for some quick, easy cash. He started to drink heavily at this point and started to go out and party. He went out to a bar in Denver one night solo and sat at the bar. The bartender that night was a pretty 23-year-old named Christina Hernandez, who was originally from San Diego. He said he was instantly attracted to her, and he sat at the bar until it closed down sometime after 2. He gave Christina his number, and in just a few weeks, he referred to Christina as his girlfriend. At the time, Tim really needed a place to stay, and fearing he would ruin things with Christina, he asked JP if he could stay with him for a short time. That was the summer of 2006. He went back to a recruiter to see if he could still enlist in the National Guard. He was told he could do so, be reenlisted, even though he was never really in to begin with. He didn't stay with JP more than a few weeks,
the plan was for Tim to actually go to boot camp this time. He stayed in a bedroom on the east side of the home, and there is only Tim, and that is only Tim's word at the trial to verify that. He then stayed with a friend of his named Denny that lived in West Denver after he left JP's house. He was getting back into escorting at this time because, well, it seemed that nothing in the straight world was really panning out for him. He would go out to L.A. to do his escorting for an agency called Meet the Stars. A man named David Forrest owns it. Forrest is the middleman that arranges dates between high-profile porn stars and male clients. I talked to David Forrest about his dealings with him. He is a convicted felon and spent time in prison on pandering and other felonious charges. He was extremely concerned about me revealing that he's the Heidi Fleiss of the porn world. He was very guarded about his dealings with Tim, but said he made him a lot of money because he had such a huge following and men just adored him and would do anything and pay anything to be with him. Forrest said he had a shitload of entitlement issues. He thought the world owed him everything. He was always pissed off at one thing or another. Chichi LaRue said almost the same exact thing about Tim when we talked about Tim's arrest later on down the line. It's quite sad the way his burned bridges can light the path to eternity.
Wow. That is just
there's
a lot
of cast of characters in this book, a very interesting array.
Yes,
of them.
Yes, it is. Mm-hmm. Most definitely it is. Very good book. Can you let everybody know how they can get your book and how they can get in touch with you? Are you on Facebook
or
any social medias?
So the book is called Intended for Mature Audiences. If it's not at your bookstore, you can ask for it. You can ask for it at the library. You can get it on Amazon.com. You can get it through the publisher, W&B Publishers. The easiest way is on Amazon. That's how most people buy books nowadays. It's the largest bookseller in the world, Amazon. So that's how they can get it. You can get in touch with me on Twitter, Ms. Donna Thomas. DonnaThomas. That's a good way to get me.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I have articles. I have lots of exclusives that I do. I interview, like, Karen Severson recently, the one that was in the Killer Among Friends, if you guys saw that movie with Patty Duke, played the mother. She's out of prison now, her and the other one. So I interviewed her recently, and the article is there on FanDaily, FanDaily.info. All my articles there. I interview a lot of people, and my articles are there, so that people can read all of that there, too.
Okay, and you're on Facebook? Where's your Facebook
URL? I'm on Facebook, but I'm kind of, I've got to move it over to a public page. I haven't, because it's up to 5,000, so best way is Twitter.
Oh, okay.
Technology, I haven't caught up with it yet, to be honest. The first thing I wrote and got paid for was written on a typewriter.
Wow. That was
a long time. Yes, I've been doing it a long time. But Twitter is a good place. You send me a tweet, and we'll get, if somebody has a case they want me to look at, I try to write about at least one missing child a month, because that's very important, somebody that's missing. Anyone has something they want me to look at, find me on Twitter. That's a very good way.
Okay. So I'm going to ask.
Do you do unsolved murders?
Excuse me?
Do you do unsolved murders?
Well, you know, I'm working on another story, actually, that I'm working on out of Orange County, California. It's the Zaharias children that were supposedly abducted by their mother 27 years ago. But it's the father, I believe, and he's sitting free in Orange County. I've been writing a lot of articles about that case. I believe that the father probably either hired someone to kill them. He makes believe they're missing and that the mother took them and he can't see them, but I don't believe that. I believe they're dead, all three of them, and that he probably either did it himself or had somebody else, because he refuses to be interviewed by me. And he pleads on Facebook and all over that if anybody has seen them, you know, blah, blah, blah. But he hasn't done any interviews in front of a camera in 27 years. So, and he refuses to be interviewed. He makes up all kinds of stories, and I just feel it. From all my years of working these cases, I just feel that he had something to do with their disappearance, and that they're probably dead because they haven't surfaced in 27 years. The boy was 5 and the girl was 2, and the mother was 26 at the time that they went missing. So if anybody knows anything, I've been trying to reach her family members. I think also in this case that there's more dead than only just the three of them. I think there could be others dead also in relation. It's a fascinating case, so I'm constantly working on that one as well. Zaharias with a Z, Z-A-H-A-I-R-S. If anyone knows anything, please... Yeah, please get in touch with me if anyone knows anything about any of those. If anyone has seen them or knows that they're alive and hiding, anything. Knows that they're not dead. Knows for a fact that they're still alive, those people. I'd love to hear from you.
Wow. Okay, everybody, if you're out there listening, and if you hear anything about the case of the three missing little girls, get in touch with Donna Thomas on Twitter.
Thank you. Thank you very
much. And we're going to... We really did enjoy this show with you this evening, Donna, and anytime you want to come back, you know how to get in touch with me.
Okay, thank you.
You know,
Gail,
and I did. Right, and I love the book. Everybody get that book from Amazon. The title is For Intended Audience, and it's by Donna Thomas, a true crime story. And I love those type of stories as well because, you know, I love reading books that, I like reading autobiographies and books that, you know, such as true crime and books with truth in it, you know, true crime and, you know, books where they are trying to track down killers and, you know, different things of the sort. So this was a very good book, so I suggest you guys go out and get this book from Amazon or you can go into the bookstore and request it as well. The title of the book isn't For Intended Audience, and it's the story of adult film star Timothy J. Boham, a.k.a. Marcus Allen. And you won't be disappointed because I wasn't. In some books, I can't get after the first 10. If the first 10 pages don't grab me in, I can't even finish reading the book. But this book grabbed me in from the very beginning. And it is a good book, so, you know,
thank
get out there and get it. And we're going to give you a great big round of applause for being our guest this evening.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I really appreciate it.
Okay, Jadino, did you have any closing remarks?
No, I was just listening, and like I said,
okay.
I find a lot of the stuff she was talking about interesting.
Oh, okay. Jay, do you have any questions or comments or closing?
I just want to say it was a fascinating show. My mouth is dropped. I'm like, wow, I can't wait to have her back on again because this was very interesting, and I really want to get that book now, so...
Thank you very much, guys. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Yes.
You're welcome.
Okay, Jay, do you want to let everybody know how they can get in touch with you?
Oh, well, they can check us out every Thursday at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on Erotic Talk Radio, and where Miss Delicious is my co-host. And, they can check our group out on Facebook as well, Erotic Talk Radio. Yeah. Thank you.
Okay, you're welcome, dear. Jadino, you want to let everybody know how to get in touch with you?
Oh, yeah, you can hit me on Facebook. You can Gmail me at j.dinoblaschko@gmail.com. I got some stuff coming up I'm working on. Got a lot of FX stuff I'm doing. I'm going to be mind-blowing this year.
Yeah, Jadino is a very talented young man. He's an actor. He does everything, makeup, shoes. I mean, he's just multi-talented. He even sings, plays the guitar, everything. So. Very multi-talented young man.
That's
so
why I like
friend him on Facebook. Friend of mine on Facebook, you do T-shirts, hats, shoes, everything. You know, so Jadino is a guy to go to. And myself, you all know who I am.
But I'm just going to let you guys know that Bringing Sexy Back is for the mature listener audience, and our subject matter is sometimes sexual, but it's not limited to other social topics. We discuss relationships, current events, and issues relevant to everyday life. We appreciate you, Donna Thomas, for being our guest and our listener audience. And if you have a topic you'd like for us to discuss or would like to be a guest on the show, send an email to me. That's gjdelicious37@gmail.com. And in the subject line, type topic or guest. We're here every Wednesday at 10:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, giving you guys the best guests and adult conversations on Blog Talk Radio. Remember, bringing sexy back does not mean you've lost your sexy. Bringing sexy back is a state of mind and how you perceive yourself. Thank you, Jade. Thank you, Terry. And thank you, Jadino, for being my host this evening and my listening audience. Love you guys. Be safe. Have a wonderful weekend. Remember, if you're driving, don't drink. And if you're drinking, don't drive. I just love, love, love talking to you guys, not about you. Everybody have a beautiful weekend. See you guys next week when my special guest will be Corey Hines. He's a fictional writer. He writes science fiction, and he's going to be our guest for next week. So see you guys next Wednesday. Good night, everybody, and thank you.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night. Good night.
My Nana got the best radio show on the internet.